Roses are red, tomatoes are too. There's too much in this house for one woman to do. Welcome to episode 4 of the Crooked Row podcast. I am Kim, coming to you from eastern Nebraska, where I've been sweating and keeping my fingers busy. I'm kind of podcasting from the seat of my pants today. I haven't had a lot of time to prepare for the podcast. I've jotted down a few notes of things I want to talk about, but it might be a little more brief than usual, just because I've got a lot going on today. I've got 4 dozen cupcakes that just came out of the oven that as soon as they cool, I need to get them decorated and get them off to a bridal shower because I cannot say no. So I'm going to jump right into it. This week I've got a knitting segment updating on what I've been working on. I'll update from my garden what's growing and being harvested and doing well out there. We have a question this week from a listener about roses. And I've also got a quick make yourself useful segment. So get comfortable. Here we go. Update on my knitting. I am still working on the Sarissa cardigan, which is a chic knits pattern by Bon Marie Burns that I'm making out of Universal Yarns Summer Linen, which is a 50-50 cotton linen blend. I have finished the body of it, the fronts and the back, and I have picked up the stitches on one sleeve and I'm working down the sleeve, doing the decreases. And can I just say, I do not enjoy doing decreases in a lace pattern where you kind of, at the end of the round, you got to figure out, well, do I do a decrease and then the yarn over, or do I work these few stitches in stockinette? Because you've got to keep your ratio of the decreases and yarn overs correct, but then you've also got to do a decrease every so many rounds, and oh, it's just too much thinking sometimes at the end of the day. So, I'm working on that. Making progress with it. I have a feeling I'm going to have to go back and rip out the bottom hem and add another inch to it. I should have done that initially, but when I tried it on, I thought it looked all right, but I think I'm going to go ahead and make it longer because it is a machine washable yarn, but there's still a little bit of potential for shrinkage. When I washed my swatch in the washing machine and then laid it flat to dry, I did really have to kind of tug at it to get it stretch out back out to its original dimensions. So if this does shrink, it's going to be a little too short. So I think I might rip it out. It's not real hard because it is a top-down pattern, so it won't be real hard to just rip out that bottom inch or so of the hem and add another inch onto it just for safety. Better too long than too short. The other project I was working on last week, which was the Rick Socks by Cookie A from the Sock Innovation book. I have finished the Rick Socks, and I really like them, except my tension changed, and this hasn't ever happened to me on a pair of socks. I mean, it happens from time to time. It's not that unusual, but I knit them one right after the other, no big break in between them or anything. And I had gone up to the size 2 needles after starting out on 1.5 because that was too tight with the 1.5. So I went up to a 2 and finished the first sock. But the first sock is significantly tighter than the second sock. The second sock is much more comfortable. But since I've already put in enough effort to make 3 socks, I don't really want to knit another one. It'd be like as much work to knit one pair of socks as it should be to knit 2 pairs of socks, and they're all right. Once I get them on, I don't think I'm going to notice it wearing the socks, but if I really think about it, I can tell one's a lot easier to get over my heel than the other, so nobody else will notice. But I like those. That was done in the Spud and Chloe Fine yarn, which is, I believe it's 80% superwash wool and 20% silk, I believe. And that's a nice yarn. It's a nice, plump, round yarn. Really good stitch definition. It's not buttery soft, but it feels like it's very durable, strong yarn, so they should last real well. I also picked back up with the Critter Mitt Puppets, which is a Knit Picks kit that I ordered a few weeks, a month or so ago, and made another one of those puppets. I made the sea monster, although my son tells me I am not done with it because I have not embroidered the eyes on it yet, but everything else is done. He refuses to play with it until I get the eyes on it because, in his mind, that is what makes it come to life, and I have not done that, but everything else is done. It turned out pretty well. It's a toy where there's lots of little pieces you've got to sew on, which are kind of fiddly, but hey, it's worth it. My kid likes it. So that's the second one of those I have done. There's still four more patterns in the kit. I'll slowly work my way through those. Something else I cast on this week, since I was finished with my Rick socks, I wanted to start another pair of socks. And this is also a pattern that I downloaded from the Knit Picks website, but it's one of their patterns in their independent designer program where the patterns are all $1.99. But I think how it works is almost all of that goes directly to the designer, but all the patterns are done using Knit Picks yarn, so it's kind of a mutually beneficial thing for everybody. But there's some really good patterns in that. The one I started is little fish socks for toddler preschool age kids. I can't remember what the exact name of it is. I'll link to it in the show notes. It's by Melissa Dominguez, and it's little colorwork fish worked on a bright blue background. And I'd originally bought some of their hand-painted stroll sock yarn, which is what it called for the fish, and then you work it on a solid blue background, so you've got little multicolored fish. But I was informed by my 4-year-old that he could not see the fish clearly enough, so instead I went with a solid green for the fish and the bright blue for the background. And I'm going to call these socks my little crack fishy socks because they are so addicting. They are just so cute that once you start working on one row of fish, I just can't stop knitting. I can't put it down until I finish those little fish. It's so rewarding to see that cute little row of little fish all lined up. So that is coming along nicely. This is the first colorwork sock I've ever done. So it's fun. Not the first colorwork ever that I've done. I've done a few hats and mittens, but never a sock. So it seems to be fitting him well. It's a lot of stitches for a kid's sock. And I know with the color work, it kind of pulls in, so your stitch gauge is smaller than what you would normally expect for that number of stitches. But I'm making the 3 to 5 year old size sock, and it's 60 stitches, which is, and that's worked on size 2 needles with the fingering weight yarn. So that's not uncommon for adults to have socks with that many stitches on them, but like I said, it does pull in, and there's not as much stretch being that it's color work. So it's working out. I think I'm going to change the pattern a little bit when I get down to the foot. Because the pattern as it's written, you do a short row heel, which is fine. I don't see that being a problem. But then the foot of the sock is not worked in color work. It's just the entire foot is worked in 1-1 rib. And I think that just kind of might drive me crazy. And I know why she did that is because you have 60 stitches. And if you're not working them in color work all the way down the foot, you're going to have a really, really wide foot for a 3 to 5 year old. So I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to do. I might find a way to just decrease those stitches, or I might go down a few needle sizes. Or I might just do ribbing on the top and stockinette on the bottom or something like that. But I don't know if I really like the look of the 1-1 rib all the way down. And it would be really annoying to work like 3 or 4 inches or whatever it'll be to the toe to do all in knit one, purl one. So we'll see. I might even get crazy and just continue the fish all down the top of the sock and then just do like alternating green, blue across the foot of the sock. I'll see how that goes. So that is what I have been knitting on. In the garden, I have been more or less swamped with produce, which is fine. We're keeping up on it so far. We've got cucumbers coming out of our ears, and the tomatoes are really coming on strong now. I've got lots and lots of Roma tomatoes that I just got some of them stuck in the freezer yesterday, which I will talk about in the Make Yourself Useful segment. We're continuing to get a lot of squash and beans and all that sort of thing. And it's been a lot of fun watching our melons grow. This is the first year I've ever grown watermelon and cantaloupe. And man, they are crawling over everything. They are taking over the whole garden, which I knew they would. And that's fine. It covers the ground and crowds out some of the weeds that I'm sure are trying to grow underneath there. We have two good-sized watermelons and one little baby one that I'm not sure if it's going to continue developing or if it's going to dry up and fall off. The vines originally had several melons on them, and it kind of did what a lot of fruit will do, is it almost self-prunes out some fruit. Several of the little melons just dried up and fell away, and all of the energy and nutrients are all going to the two melons, so that's fine. We don't really need to have a dozen watermelons that come ripe all at the same time. We also have several cantaloupes. There's probably about half a dozen of those, and they are coming along well. Not ripe yet. And by the way, do you know how to tell when your melons are ripe? I see people at the grocery store where they're slapping the watermelons to see if they're ripe, and it's just hilarious because I'm really not sure what they're listening for, but you really can't tell if a watermelon's ripe by slapping it. But don't stop doing it. I mean, it's fun. I do it too, because there's nothing more fun than the nice sound of slapping a firm watermelon. That sounds strange, but it's nice. It's part of the experience. Continue doing it, please. Don't let me slow you down on that. But how you actually tell if a melon is ripe or not is from the color. Every watermelon, the part that rests on the ground, you have the spot where there's a break from the green striping around it, and it's either a white or a yellow patch on the bottom. And how you know if it's ripe is when that patch turns from white to yellow. When the watermelon is still growing and green and developing, it's white. If you roll it over and you see it starting to turn creamy yellow, that's when you can harvest it. And the stems also are easier to separate from the melon at that time too. So you shouldn't have to tug and wrench and destroy your vines just to get your melon off. If that's the case, it might not be ripe. We have had an aphid outbreak on our pumpkin plants, and I'm wondering if that's because I've done more spraying of insecticides this year than I usually do to keep the squash vine borers off, which I mentioned in, I believe, the second episode. I've been doing more spraying of that because I have so many cucurbit plants, and I really wanted to make sure that they didn't all go down. I did lose a few vines here and there because I was a little late getting started doing my preventative spraying, but in the process of spraying that insecticide, it doesn't just kill the squash vine borers. It's going to kill anything it comes in contact with, including things like the ladybugs. And I'm wondering if, because I also might have killed off some of the beneficial insects, that's why I saw an outbreak of aphids, because I usually don't see that on pumpkin type plants like the cucurbits. So just something interesting. Your garden is dynamic. Everything you do has an effect, and it's just interesting to see how different things interact and fluctuate throughout the year. But with aphids on anything, if you've got an outbreak on aphids, the first thing you should do is just take a hose and turn it on really high pressure and just squirt it down and more or less power wash them off. they're not extremely mobile. So it's not like if you wash them all off, they're all just going to jump right back on the plant. Most of them will just not be able to make it back to the plant. So before you do anything to treat with any kind of insecticide, natural or synthetic, the first thing you should do is just rinse them off with a hose. And more often than not, that will take care of your problem, unless it's a really severe infestation. Oh, and something fun that my kids and I found yesterday. I grew dill this year, and the dill is kind of winding down. It's flowering and starting to die back a little bit. But what we found on our dill plants yesterday were a whole bunch of swallowtail caterpillars. And if you've seen these, they're very distinctive. They are striped with white, yellow, and black. And they're pretty sizable. I mean, they can be anywhere from like an inch or so when they're little to as big as your pinky finger. They get pretty big, cute, pudgy, smooth little caterpillars. And they really like dill. And I think fennel also is something that they really enjoy. I've never grown fennel because I don't like eating it. But if you want to attract swallowtail butterflies to your garden, plant dill or fennel because that's what they're little babies like to eat, and if you have good food for their babies, you will have the beautiful adults. Now, mind you, that means you're going to have to share your dill and fennel because they need to eat it, but just plant a few plants extra and you'll be fine. It's worth it. But my kids had more fun yesterday trying to provoke the little caterpillar, because if you get them a little bit scared, if you try and pick them up and squeeze them ever so gently, they have this little defense mechanism where they shoot out these little orange horn-looking things off of their head to try and make them look a little more intimidating or something, try and scare away predators. But they just look like two little sticks of orange jello or something that just pop out of nowhere on their heads, and then they kind of suck back in once the caterpillar becomes comfortable again. It's really funny to watch. They had more fun playing with these caterpillars. Luckily, none of them were fatally injured in this play. So, moving on to our garden question this week is from Erin of the Anatomy of Knitting podcast. She is Knitting RN on Ravelry. And her question was about roses, and she is having some disease issues, it sounds like, on the leaves of her roses, and then just general rose care as well. And she had mentioned that she had some spots, and she had removed the leaves that looked most infected to keep it from spreading to the other plants, and was just wondering if that was the appropriate thing to do. And yes, it was. Rose foliar diseases are very similar to what I talked about with the tomatoes and their foliar diseases with the early blight. Was that in episode 2 or 3 that I talked about that? I've got a really terrible memory. that was not that long ago. But I talked about early blight with how you want to remove the infected leaves and then spray with a fungicide. Well, the roses are very similar. When you start seeing those spots on the leaves, that is it's a fungal infection is what it is. Black spot is a fungus. That's probably the most common thing you see. Rust is also really common. Rust is different on the leaves. It looks like little orange freckles, but it's also a fungus. It just looks a little different. You treat them the same way. But the most important thing is to remove all of the spotty, nasty-looking leaves that are usually going to be on the lower part of the plant. Remove them and destroy them. Compost them if you know that your compost is getting hot enough. If you don't know that your compost is getting up to at least 135 degrees Fahrenheit, sorry, I don't know what that is in Celsius. If it's not getting that hot, just toss them in the trash, because otherwise you're going to be reinfecting your plants again next year. And then you can spray with a fungicide. And most, you don't always have to spray your roses every week, all summer long. There are people who do. And in certain climates, it might be more of an issue if it's really moist. But there's some cultural things that you can do to help keep the disease from getting too bad so that you hopefully won't have to be out spraying them all the time. The first thing is locating your plants in a proper location. Roses like sun. They like sun because it gives them enough energy to be able to grow and produce nice, beautiful flowers. But something else about being in the sun is that sun will dry off the dew on the leaves and keep the leaves drier. These foliar diseases are really encouraged by wet conditions. So if your rose's leaves are getting wet from dew or irrigation, like from a sprinkler where it's getting all over the leaves, and then they don't dry off right away, that's going to really, really encourage black spot, rust, and other fungal diseases. So planting them somewhere where they're going to get sun first thing in the morning and dry off would be a really good idea. Also, you don't want to let your roses get too thick and bushy. If you've got a variety that's going to get really thick and bushy, you might want to go in and thin out some of those canes every now and then to keep the airflow good through there, and that's going to help prevent the spread of disease. And again, it works the same way, just with the airflow drying the leaves off faster. The other thing that you want to make sure you're doing, again, it goes back to sanitation, is in the fall when your leaves are falling off, you want to remove all of those leaves and rake them up and dispose of them properly to where they're not going to overwinter right at the base of that plant. Get as much of the leaves as you can away from there. The other thing to remember is that some roses get diseases worse than others, and it's not necessarily shrub roses get less than tea roses all the time. It has to do with genetics and breeding, and they run these roses through tests and all sorts of things like that to test their disease resistance. So very often you'll find on the label if it is somewhat or very resistant to these fungal diseases, it will say so. So look for that when you're purchasing roses, especially if you live in a moist or humid environment. Another question that people ask a lot about roses is, when do I prune my roses? When do I prune my roses? And roses really aren't as picky as people seem to think they are about pruning. You don't just want to hack at them, but they're really not as tricky as people might think that they are. I always prune my roses in the spring when I'm just starting to see the buds start to swell, where you can see where the leaves are going to start growing. And this gives me a good indication of how much of those canes have died back over the winter. It's going to depend on where you live, and it's going to depend on what kind of roses you grow as to how much has died back. It's not uncommon for a lot of roses to die almost clear back to the ground. As long as, if it's a grafted rose, as long as it's not dying down below the graft, you're fine. It'll grow back. If you have a grafted rose and you start seeing a lot of shoots coming up from underground that are not looking like the rose that you initially bought from the nursery, then you might have problems, and that would be your rootstock taking over. But as long as your graft union stays good, you're fine. So in the spring, all I do for my roses is basically just reshape them, thin them out as needed if they're getting overgrown and need to be thinned out. And just like any other pruning that you do, you want to make sure that you're making that cut about a quarter of an inch above a bud, so you're not going to leave a big stump of dead stem above the new growth point. So just locate the uppermost bud that you want to keep and make your cut on an angle about a quarter to a half an inch above that bud. But I just take out the dead stuff, and from what's left, I just kind of reshape it to be a nice rounded shape, a natural shape, not hedged off like a little meatball, but just a nice natural shape. Usually this ends up being like a foot or less because my Floribunda rose that I grow tends to die back pretty low. The shrub roses that I grow, which are the rainbow knockout roses, they're a little more hardy as far as that top growth goes. They still get some winter dieback, and I'll just go in and prune out the stuff that dies back a little bit. I haven't had them for very long, so I haven't had to do a lot of pruning on them because they're just now starting to get to be their full size. But if you have shrub roses and they're starting to look a little overgrown and too thick and dead twiggy stuff all over in them, you can also go in that early spring, just before the buds start to open, but late enough that you can see what's alive and what's not. You can go in and cut them back to 6 to 12 inches high, and they'll regrow from the base, and that'll rejuvenate your plant. To encourage more flowering during the growing season, you want to do a little bit of deadheading on your rose bush, whatever variety it is. That'll help get the seeds and the rose hips off and promote more blooming so that the plant's energies are going towards that. And generally what the recommendation is to just prune back far enough until you're getting to the first leaf that has five little leaflets. If you look at a rose, one leaf is made up of several small leaflets. And as you get higher and higher towards the end of the stems where the flowers are, they have fewer leaflets. So you want to go down to where there's a leaf that has five leaflets. Or if you're lazy like me, you go out and just kind of with your fingers just snap off the dead flowers. Because honestly, I'm not going to go count leaflets. If that's your thing, that's great. But I usually just snap off the dead flowers with my fingers. Towards fall, though, I like to leave the rose hips, which is the seed, the fruit part of the rose bush, where the flowers were, little rose hips will develop. There are a lot of varieties of shrub roses where those are really an ornamental quality to the plant. Not all of them, but there are several that are. And usually that's something that they'll mention on the tag when you are looking at roses, that if it has ornamental hips. The ones that I have on the rainbow knockouts aren't really big. They're maybe nickel-sized. But I like to leave those on because in the fall, they get orange, and they're just, when the leaves die off, they're just kind of a pretty ornamental structure to the plant. Some people use hips on roses to make jellies and things like that. They're very nutritious. They're very high in vitamin C. So if you have a rose, a lot of the rugosa shrub roses have really large hips on them, and those can be used for that purpose. They're pretty seedy, so I've never actually used them myself for that, but there's a large seed cavity in there and not a lot of flesh. So I have never really done that because I haven't had roses that have had enough to really work with. But if you do, it's something to think about. Lastly is fertilizer. Roses are pretty heavy feeders. Virtually all of my perennials and shrubs and trees in my landscape, I don't fertilize them on a regular basis unless they really look like they're needing it. But by and large, you don't need to be adding much fertilizer beyond compost and a nice organic mulch, which would be wood chips or something like that. Because as that stuff breaks down, it's adding nutrients back to the soil. Beyond that, you really shouldn't need to be adding a lot of fertilizer unless you know you have a really infertile soil that you're growing in. But by and large, those perennial things I don't fertilize. I fertilize more things like annuals and in the vegetable garden where something grows, it's harvesting nutrients from the soil, it gets removed, and you're taking those nutrients out of that system. Then you need to be putting something back in to replenish it. Otherwise, you're going to deplete your soil. But if I'm going to fertilize anything in my perennial shrub landscape, it is the roses. and it's not really that tricky. I just go out in the spring when the leaves are starting to come out and throw a couple tablespoons of time-release fertilizer around the base of the plant and kind of scratch it in under the mulch so that every time it rains or every time you water, it's going to be releasing a small amount of fertilizer into the root system. And that's all I do. Not too tricky. I'm also going to link in the show notes to a video segment that was done by a graduate student who works in my lab at work. Not my lab. It's not my lab. The lab that I work in. It's a video segment that aired on a program called Backyard Farmer, which is on our local PBS station here in Nebraska. It's a locally produced show that has extension specialists in entomology, plant pathology, horticulture, and they answer call-in questions from people across the state. It's a really great resource. If you live anywhere in this area, you would find a lot of information beneficial on there. But I'll link to this video. It talks about the rose diseases more than anything else. It's just about the diseases. But there are some images there of roses that are infected with black spot and also with rust. So if you think you might have those issues, this is something where you can look at it and see what it looks like. They talk pretty much the same sorts of things that I talked about managing diseases, but something to look at, and there's some pretty rose pictures, so yay, that's fun. It's not real long. It's maybe 5 minutes or so. So hopefully that covered everything you would like to know about roses. It's a pretty brief summation of rose culture. Lastly, this week in Make Yourself Useful, I want to talk about preserving your produce. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because I could spend, you know, 5 or 6 podcasts just talking about canning. Not that I'm an expert canner, but there's just a lot of information to cover. This is more just a general get yourself thinking about maybe preserving some of your produce. I do some canning every year. I grow a lot of tomatoes, a lot of Roma tomatoes, which are the paste tomatoes. They have a small seed cavity and not a lot of that, the watery gel stuff that you find on the inside of the tomato. They have thicker walls, so it's a good tomato to use if you're making sauces or salsa or things like that. You're getting more pulp per pound of tomatoes. So I grow those and I do salsa and spaghetti sauce. And last year I made a canned bruschetta topping. Now usually when you find the bruschetta topping, it's just the chopped up tomatoes and onions and basil and it's fresh. And so this is a little different. It's obviously a cooked form of that with the processing, with the canning. It involves a lot of heat. So it was very tasty. Very nice to eat on garlic bread. I haven't done as much along the way of freezing. The types of things that you would freeze, I don't usually get enough quantity to really justify doing that. I froze a little bit of broccoli this year. Sometimes I freeze some tomatoes to use for stews and things like that. Most of what I do is canning. But if canning seems intimidating to you and you don't want to invest in the supplies it takes for canning, which is not a tremendous amount. I mean, you can get one of the smaller, just water bath canners for about $20. But then if you don't have any jars or lids or rings for the jars, that can be somewhat of an investment depending on how much you're doing. But freezing is not an investment. All you really need are some good, sturdy freezer bags. The thing to remember with freezing vegetables is that for most things that you're freezing, you're really supposed to blanch them. And the reason you want to do this, which is dunking them into some boiling water for just a short amount of time. Not until you're cooking everything all the way through, but I think usually what you do is you have the water boiling, you put in a small batch of vegetables, and then you wait for the water to start bubbling again, and then you remove them and freeze them. And the reason you want to do that is because it stops those enzymes that continue the ripening of that vegetable or fruit, and it just helps preserve the flavor. One thing I'm going to try this year that I haven't tried in the past, which is a tip that I got from someone else actually, is with zucchini or yellow squash, the yellow crookneck summer squash, which if you have one hill, you have more than you can probably eat. And you're trying to leave them on your neighbor's front step when they're not home and trying to do whatever you can to get rid of them, because by this time of year, you're getting so sick of zucchini and squash, you could just puke. But here's a tip for preserving it to make it more useful throughout the year. If you like making zucchini bread, something you can do is shred up your zucchini when it's fresh. You don't have to cook it. Just shred it up with like a large cheese shredder and freeze baggies of that in the portions that you would use for a recipe of zucchini bread. So you can have your fresh zucchini bread all year. The friend who also told me about this mentioned that they use this shredded zucchini or summer squash even just to mix it in with hamburger. If they're making hamburgers, it just makes the meat stretch farther and it makes it really moist. So that's something to try. We're starting to get to a point where we're all getting a little tired of the yellow crookneck squash, and I'm thinking about using it for something like that. I'm assuming that using a yellow crookneck squash would be interchangeable with zucchini in making zucchini bread. I mean, they're very, very similar, except for the color, which really doesn't matter in the zucchini bread. So I'm hoping to use some of it for that purpose and do a little bit of freezing of the squash. So if you find yourself in that situation where you've got more than you can handle at this point in time, maybe think about some quick, easy ways you can do preserving. Canning can be a lot of time. Yesterday I had, I don't know how many pounds of tomatoes that I harvested, and I blanched them and peeled them and then removed the seeds. And what I was left with was just the pulp that I will use at a later date to make spaghetti sauce or coarsely chop it up and put it with onions and peppers to make salsa. But for now, I'm just stashing them away in the freezer. And then when I get a really large, giant batch of tomatoes in there all together, I'll get them all out and do one big batch of canning all at one time, preferably on one of the first nice, cool days of September, so I don't have a boiling water bath in my house when it's 95 degrees outside. But what I ended up with after, a good hour and a half to 2 hours at least of working on these tomatoes was like a gallon baggie plus about another third of another gallon baggie, which is a little humbling. I mean, at some point you got to think, how hard is it just to go to the store and buy a can of stewed tomatoes? But that's not really all it's about, is it? I mean, if you knit, you don't knit because you're trying to be more efficient. I mean, you could go to Target and buy a sweater for $15. It's not really about that. It's more about enjoying the process and feeling like you know where your food is coming from and being more connected to it. It's more about having something homemade than just having something. So that's why I do it. Here's the secret. Don't tell anybody, but I actually prefer the store-bought Prego spaghetti sauce to what I make and can. I know, right? Yeah, if it was up to me, I would just eat the Prego traditional sauce from the grocery store. It's my favorite, but my husband really likes the stuff I make. So I make it every year for him. He does not like sweet spaghetti sauces. He likes them with absolutely no sugar, which is, you know, whatever. It's his taste. So I make it for him, and it makes me feel very good that he loves it and savors it and spaces out the using of it all winter long to try and make it last as long as he can. So that makes me feel special. But sometimes I mix it with Prego. Don't tell anybody. That is going to about wrap it up. I have forgotten to mention what I had talked about last episode about the fall 2010 Knit Scene magazine, where I accidentally/mistakenly acquired two copies of that. If you are interested in receiving a copy of that, go to the thread that we have on the Ravelry group site, the Crooked Row Podcast group site. And I have a thread in there to win that issue. And it's along the lines of last week, well, no, not last week, 2 weeks ago, episode 3, when I was talking about combination plants, things that you plant together. If you go on that link and just give a suggestion for a couple things that you like to grow in combination, either in succession, like we talked about, where something grows in the spring and then something else moves in the summer, or if it's just things that you like to plant next to each other, just go in there and add your suggestion. Somebody had put something in there about how all that grew were weeds, and it was something like dandelions and water grass or something. That's awesome. If all you grow is weeds, you are welcome here. Welcome. no one will throw stones at you. I think that's awesome. So whatever it is, or if you don't do any gardening at all, it's just go throw your name in the hat, whatever. And on the next episode, which is in 2 weeks from today, today is the 7th of August, 2 weeks from today, I will just do a random number generator thing and pick a name out of the hat, and somebody will get an issue of the 2010 Fall Knit Scene magazine. So that's going to bring it to an end. I have managed to ramble on much longer than I planned on. Hopefully I can get this edited and up today. If you want to get a hold of me, I am Crooked Row on Ravelry. You can also email me at crookedrow@gmail.com. Show notes for this podcast will be posted sometime shortly, probably not today, but in a couple days at the show notes site, which is thecrookedrow.blogspot.com. Music is provided by Music Alley. And I also just wanted to say thank you for listening. I should have probably put that at the beginning of the podcast. But thank you. I keep checking the stats on my past episodes, and I'm kind of blown away at how many people have downloaded them. So thank you. Thank you to the other podcasters who have mentioned me on their podcasts, because I know that that's where a lot of listeners are coming from. So thank you for that. Thanks for giving me a listen. Hopefully it's something interesting and helpful to you. So have a great week knitting. Have a great week in your garden. Enjoy your fresh produce while you have it. It will not last forever. And I must go now and decorate 4 dozen cupcakes. I'd rather be knitting. Have a great week. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.